Next case, Keatley versus Bruner.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Sanders, attorney for appellant homeowner Dwayne Bruner. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my 10 minutes. This case is about a one-page document, which I previously distributed to the court, entitled Earnest Money Receipt and Agreement. The trial court concluded, as a matter of law, that it was valid and legally enforceable. This caused Mr. Bruner to lose his home and his farm at a discount of $205,000, according to the trial court. We submit that this is a reversible error. What the trial court purported to be an open-ended purchase option contract is void and unenforceable because it lacks consideration, it lacks material terms, it's an unreasonable restraint on alienation, and finally, it violates the rule against perpetuities. We begin with the document itself. This case is governed by the statute of frauds, and there are a number of requirements that have been violated by not only what the document says, but what the document fails to say. For example, although this purports to be a purchase agreement, and it says Sandra Jo Keatley hereby agrees to purchase, the trial court rejected that in finding Q. When it said, although they entitled the contract as an earnest money receipt agreement, the lack of a closing date, the uncontroverted testimony that the date was left open intentionally to allow plaintiff time to finance the purchase of the property, and the party's actions post-execution established that they intended to create an open-ended purchase option contract. So under an option, Ms. Keatley has no duty to do anything. She can just sit back. And she can set back for her life, and she can set back, after her life, her assigns don't need to do anything, but Mr. Bruner has to hold this property open pursuant to the option. It's also noteworthy that this option is for a fixed price, $295,000, distinguishing this case from the first right of refusal cases or the preemption cases, which call for a different standard. As I indicated, the court found that there was no closing date by the intention of the parties. This was not an oversight or an omission. It was intentional. The court found that in finding H. The contract contains no restriction on assignability or testamentary transfer. The option may be exercised long after Ms. Keatley's demise. The reference in the contract to $1,000 is for the purchase price. We contend that there is no substantial evidence demonstrating, as the court found, that the purchase price was actually paid. But beyond that, there's no contention that there was any independent consideration for the option to hold this property available for purchase for an indeterminate period of time.
On the payment of $1,000, is that a credibility question for the trial court? I mean, the trial court found that Ms. Keatley had tendered the money and that Mr. Bruner didn't cash the check.
No, Your Honor, the court didn't find that Ms. Keatley had tendered the money. The court found that Keatley paid Bruner $1,000 in earnest money. This is finding F.
And do you think that's a distinction then, that because there's no actual evidence of receipt of the money,
paying money means you pay the money.
Okay.
And
not just giving a check that's never cashed.
That's correct. I mean, if Mr. Bruner got cold feet and he didn't want to cash the check, then there's no consideration. But beyond that, the court concluded and set forth in its amended judgment that to close the deal, she'd have to come up with $295,000 with no credit for any alleged non-existent earnest money. As indicated, there's no forfeiture clause for the alleged earnest money. There is no reference to future improvements on the property, allocation of risk for damage to the property, insurance, taxes, or anything else. First, we've already talked about the lack of consideration, not only lack of consideration in the terms of the alleged consideration for the purchase, but there's no reference, no allegation that there was any independent consideration for the option, and I believe that's a requirement of law for an option contract. And as to the check, Ms. Keatley was cross-examined. She could have come up with a canceled check if it had been canceled. She couldn't. She testified, "I don't know what he did with the check. I just assumed that we didn't need it because we were still friends." Well, friends and a handshake is not a valid contract without consideration. This contract may not be maintained for lack of material terms. The CVAN case held that for a contract to be valid and enforceable under the statute of frauds, it must contain all necessary and material terms. Hubble versus Ward indicated the following terms were necessary, but they were absent here. Time and manner for transferring title, procedure for declaring forfeiture of earnest money, allocation of risk with respect to damage or destruction, insurance provisions, responsibility for repairs, water and utilities, restrictions, if any, on capital improvements, liens, removal or replacement of personal property and types of use, and finally, a closing date. Those are all necessary terms. None of them were in this contract. It's void for that reason. This contract is also an unreasonable restraint on trade. It's an option. It's a perpetual option. It is a cloud on the title, and it's unreasonable. According to the restatement, such a document is unreasonable if the person imposing the restraint in the land has no interest in the land. She didn't. The restraint is unlimited in duration. It is. Or the number of people to whom the alienation is prohibited is large. In this case, it's everybody in the world except for Mrs. Keatley and her assigns. It's also unreasonable because it's a fixed price, and there is no incentive for Mr. Bruner to ever improve the property because he can't get his money back. It violates the rule against perpetuities as well. It's assignable. Ms. Keatley can assign this to someone or devise it in a testamentary devise, and it will not be vest until possibly a life in being plus 21 years. This contract is void for all four reasons, although only one reason will do. We ask the court to reverse the trial court and order that Ms. Kitley's complaint be dismissed with prejudice.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew J. Anderson, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Sandra Keatley. I want to start out with the statute of frauds issue. My understanding is, based on the papers, that Mr. Sanders has waived the statute of frauds arguments. He did make some comment on that. I would assume we're all on the same page there. I want to start with lack of consideration. I think it's probably the easiest of the four topics. A check is a negotiable instrument. It's like a promissory note. It is consideration in and of itself. When you hand someone a check, they have the right to go down and cash that check at a bank. You've given something to them. You've given them an important right, and it's a note that says, "Bank, please give this person $1,000 on my behalf." That was transferred. The testimony from my client was that she gave Mr. Bruner that check. Now, whether Mr. Bruner chose to cash that check or not is not going to nullify the fact that at the time my client gave him the right to go get $1,000 under that instrument. Similarly, if she had given him a promissory note, again, we would have consideration instantly. If the note matured and Mr. Bruner decided, you know what, I'm not going to collect it, it wouldn't undo the consideration. My opponent's statement that, well, if he gets cold feet, he can just not cash it and the contract goes away is precisely the problem. I mean, think about all the real estate transactions that are handled, and if one side decides, you know, I don't want this deal anymore, I just won't cash the check, it makes all contracts voidable by the seller just by not cashing the
check.
What
if she hadn't given him a check? Would you agree then with counsel that there was no consideration?
I think the concern with that is we also had a breakup of a CIR, and that's part of the more complicated issue here. The CIR claim had been dismissed. The parties were splitting their assets, and this was one of the things that was involved.
Well, do you regard the agreement as a bilateral contract in which the promise by each side is consideration for the contract?
I do. I think that that Mr. Bruner could have sued to enforce his contract. He didn't want to. He wanted to keep his house. And that was the problem, is I think when the parties were breaking up, I think Mr. Bruner had a desire to have my client have the home. And as time went on, as he continually encouraged her to not close, he changed his mind.
What are the reciprocal promises, though, in an open-ended option agreement? I promise you that if I want to, I'll buy this property. And
well, there's two ways to look at this. If your honors find that this was an option, then you would need to have the payment of the money. Now, I'll get to this in a minute. There is an alternate way to affirm the court and to find, no, this was not an option. This was a real estate contract with no closing date. Essential terms, just real quickly, my opponent, again, uses the real estate contract requirements, which is a financing device, to try to make a REPSA not enforceable. I think I've sort of dealt with that in my briefing. The next two arguments, the restraint on trade or restraint on alienability and the rule against perpetuities are new. These were not raised. They weren't whispered. They're, we believe, affirmative defenses. I've provided that. Not a word of this was even discussed. I was there trying the case. Another attorney was there trying the case for Mr. Bruner. The trial judge was there. We teed up the question of what's a reasonable amount of time. The parties agreed that the closing date was not put on the contract because they weren't that concerned about when it would close. And this is where our courts have said we're going to infer into this a reasonable amount of time to close. Mr. Bruner came to trial and said, I think that's 6 months. We came to trial and said, well, based on the familiar relationship, based on the fact that she lived there, that they built this together, her adjoining property, we think 5.5 years is reasonable. Also, given the equitable estoppel issues, we think it's reasonable. And we teed that up for the judge. And the judge's findings and conclusions reflect that. And to now say, well, judge, you used the word open-ended, so now a new lawyer, after all this is done, 3.5 years, trial, my client now owns the house, is going to come and say, well, you know, you said open-ended, and that could mean open-ended forever. And if you look at the record and you look at what the court has said, is there anything to find that the judge said open-ended meant open-ended forever? Or did she mean open-ended for a reasonable amount of time? Why would we litigate the question of reasonable amount of time, which took up about 80% of our trial, for the judge to then have findings of fact and conclusions of law on reasonableness, and then use the word open-ended, meaning open-ended forever? I will agree if the parties said you'll have an option for 900 years, we would have a rule against perpetuities issue. The parties didn't do that. If they said you'll have an option forever, we might have a problem. But the judge didn't find that. The judge found that the parties, because they lived, had this husband and wife type relationship, they weren't that concerned about it, so we inferred reasonableness. The reasonable restraint of alienation is a problem because, and if you look at the Lawson case at 37, 351, 354, you see the very fact-based inquiry the court's supposed to make that decision. Didn't have a chance to do that. Didn't have a chance to craft findings and conclusions. Now, if these issues had been before the judge, do you think the word open-ended would have been used, or do you think the word reasonableness would have been put on there? We don't know that. I mean, at most, we would need a remand for this court to say, well, did you mean that? Well, we don't need it because you can find an alternate way to affirm it. And then finally, every case that my opponent has cited to you on unreasonable restraint of trade and on the rule against perpetuities, we've said since the 90s, the way we deal with this now is not to sit and fantasize about various ways. Well, this person could live to be this long plus another 21 years, so no deal. And we gave that. I remember that from law school. What our court has said is we have two people here who have a contract, and we agreed there was a contract, and we're not going to, after the fact, say, you know, it could take a long time for that thing to close, so there just is no deal at all. $1,000 was paid. My client bought something that was valuable. The question is, did she close in time? And what Rob Roy, Lawson, and Fighter have all said is that when that occurs, we're going to infer a reasonable amount of time into this contract and save the deal. We're not going to just throw it away because we think they didn't have that. So again, with regard to whether this was an option or not, this court can find, based on the record, that it was not an option, that it wasn't earnest money, and that the closing was left out, and infer a reasonable amount of time on that on there, and affirm the trial court.
If it is an option agreement, what are the essential terms of an option agreement? Price?
Correct. It'd be the price. It'd be obviously the description of the property, which we have. And then when will it close? And what the court has said is, and actually what's interesting is all the cases that we cited to the court for this reasonableness of time, they all involved options.
Well, is that your preferred theory of the appeal, is that it was an option, as the trial court said, or is your preferred theory that it was not?
Well, our preferred theory is that the judge got it right and that it is an option, that she paid $1,000 for it. And if you look at the cases we cited to the court below and here, they all involved options. One of them was an option between, I think it was a father and a son, open-ended or not ended, went on for 12 years. And the court said, well, due to this familial relationship, we're going to infer a reasonable amount of time, and you know what? That's reasonable. I think the other one, there's two cases. The other case, I believe, was about 7 years, but both of them involved a family situation where the court said, now, I would agree that if this was just a stranger coming up to Mr. Bruner and saying, I'd like to buy your house, and they forget, they don't put in a closing date, and he comes back 5.5 years later and says, I'm ready to close, you'd have a different case. But she lived there the whole time. He discouraged her from closing the whole time, sat on his rights, discouraged her from closing, and the first time she said, yeah, I want to buy this now, he said no. And he didn't say he ran out of time. He said, I don't want to sell it. I'll sell it to you when I want to. So that would be our preferred. The $295, Mr. Bruner got away with an extra $1,000 on closing. I don't think there's any question that the court found the $1,000 had been paid. To say that because the court ordered my client to pay $295,000 as opposed to $294,000 is a mistake on my part. In drafting it, I probably owe my client $1,000. I mean, that's the way that went down. There's no question the court found that the $1,000 had been paid. And with that, unless your honors have additional questions, I can release my last 20 seconds.
Well, I withdrew my claim that the legal description was inadequate, but otherwise the statute of fraud certainly applies to this agreement. Mr. Anderson says that it's still a purchase agreement regardless of what the court found, that it was an option agreement, and he said that Mr. Bruner could enforce this. Well, it would take a better lawyer than I am to be able to enforce this because there's no closing date. So when is Ms. Keatley in default under this contract? Mr. Anderson says there was no mention of unreasonable restraint on alienation or the rule against perpetuities at the trial court, although he cited the leading cases on both of those doctrines. But more fundamentally, we need not come forward at the trial court and contend that. We don't know what facts the court is going to find until after the court finds those facts. And under these circumstances, RAP 2.5A2 applies, which allows a appellant at the appellate level to raise any issue for the first time on appeal, which affects the ability to maintain the action, and both unreasonable restraint on alienation and the rule against perpetuities, lack of consideration, lack of material terms, all of those affect the right to maintain the action. And it's always the burden of the party that claims a breach of contract to prove that the contract is valid before they can prove that there's a breach. I hear the dancing around about whether this is an option or a purchase agreement. It was Mr. Anderson, I believe, that drafted the language for the trial court to sign saying this was an open-ended option. And I think he was probably correct. It's an option where Ms. Keatley has no obligation to ever exercise the option, and Mr. Bruner has no right to ever withdraw the property from being subject to that option. Let's see. The discussion about the $1,000, Mr. Anderson says, well, the trial court had a typo, or maybe it was my fault. You signed my orders or my findings that I presented to the trial court. No, in the conclusions of law, the trial court interlineated that it was necessary to pay $295,000 to close this deal, which would give no credit whatsoever to the unpaid consideration, $1,000 consideration for the purchase. But nevertheless, there was still no consideration for the option, which is a necessary part of contractual validity for an option, not only consideration for the purchase price, but consideration for holding this open forever.
Thank you. Our next case this morning be Farah versus Hertz Transporting.